Today on Wings.
We were all dancing while blockading.
¿Qué queremos? ¿Cuándo la queremos?
Ahora.
¿Qué queremos?
Justicia climática.
¿Cuándo la queremos?
Ahora.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today on Wings, our topic is women strategizing for the environment. The second part of our program covers feminist activism around the international climate change process that is supposed to conclude in December 2015 in Paris, France. But we begin with an interview of a longtime feminist environmental activist, Sandra Steingraber, who's now working to save a major lake in New York from fracking contamination. The host is Melinda Tuhus.
Opposition to horizontal hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, for both oil and gas increased in the fall of 2014 as local groups carried out creative nonviolent actions. They targeted proposed pipelines, drill pads, storage facilities, and more, blaming industry for both increasing the emission of climate-changing gases and harming the health of local residents. The year ended in December with a ban in New York State on drilling for fracked gas. Sandra Steingraber is a biologist, author, and leader of the fight to ban fracking in New York with the group We Are Seneca Lake and also New Yorkers Against Fracking. Sandra Steingraber, how permanent is this ban? Could it be overturned by the legislature or the next governor?
He did not ban fracking by executive order. The environmental impact statement will reflect the new science in the Department of Health's Health Review, which is part of the draft generic supplemental environmental impact statement. So in its final form, that impact statement will call for the prohibition of fracking. So to overturn that, one would have to start the environmental impact statement process all over again, which would require public hearings and all kinds of things. So this is an enduring ban on fracking in New York.
You've emphasized the role of science and political pressure in achieving the ban. Tell us more about how that worked.
Those two things are not independent variables. The citizens are equipped with very good science. Several of us, including physicians, went town to town for years, speaking in church basements, speaking in junior high school auditoriums and to Rotary clubs, debating the gas industry and the science in universities, and really brought the science to the people. And in the early days, we only had a handful of studies. When we began this, there were only 6 studies in the peer-reviewed medical literature, in the scientific literature. Now there are 414 studies. So it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You know, when you have a few pieces, it's hard to see what the pattern is here. But as we began to fill the picture in, it became really clear that this is a menace to the climate, it's a menace to people's health, it's contaminating air and water in ways that cannot be fixed through any regulations, because obviously some parts of this infrastructure are unregulatable, if only because it's our geological bedrock. You know, you can't just go in there and regulate that. It's got fractures and fissures, and it has aquifers. It's a very complicated underground world. We don't have it all mapped. We can't control what happens when you blow it apart and inject it with lubricating toxic chemicals. Nature has its own way with things like that. And so as we got more and more damning evidence for risk and harm, we began to get this out to the public, not only in our PowerPoint presentations in church basements, but also, you know, I helped lead people to submit comments on the draft regulations. And then by laying the science out to people on websites and then translating it into plain English and inviting people to send in comments, through that process, we submitted 204,000 comments on everything that was left out of the environmental impact statement. We basically buried it alive in public comments. And those were very well-informed, scientifically-based comments, but we just kept bringing the science not only to the governor and the DOH and the DEC, but because we knew that regulatory agencies are often captured by the industries that they attempt to regulate, we brought that science directly out to the citizenry so they could become really well informed. And then, you know, there's a little bit of showmanship involved in that, because if you want someone to do some pretty complicated organic chemistry with you or really understand hydrogeology or seismicity, then you have to serve it up to people in a way that really matters to them. It can't just be clear, but also you have to persuade people that their own well-being and their own community really depends on them understanding this. And so that's what we did. I've pulled 2 or 3 all-nighters a week probably for the last 2 years. I get less sleep now than when my kids were babies. But this was a fight worth having. It was a fight for my children's future. It was a fight for the place where we live and for our air and our water. And I just had to fight with my whole heart. And I think when you do that, you can win. I think that's the message. I think we broke a spell here. You know, the spell was that oil and gas always gets what it wants. It's the biggest industry in the world. People can't fight the oil and gas industry. Well, we just did, and we took a pretty big chunk out of its armor. So I hope the legacy of this decision will reverberate much beyond the borders of New York and inspire people all over the world. And, of course, I stand ready to help with those battles. Those have to be fought by local people, but I'm sure willing to give an assist. And I'm science advisor to Americans Against Fracking, so we are fighting fracking in many states other than New York, but this win is wind in our wings, I think.
Sandra Steingraber, does the ban on drilling impact your struggle at Seneca Lake?
Directly, it doesn't. The ban on fracking only applies to actually drilling and doing horizontal high-volume hydraulic fracturing, and that we won't do in New York. But in the meantime, the gas industry is building out all the infrastructure for fracking, including pipelines and compressor stations and then storage depots. So Seneca Lake will become, if the gas industry has its way, absent our intervention, a giant gas station for all the products of fracking. Seneca Lake is one of the deepest lakes in the world. And because of that, it creates a unique microclimate around itself, which makes wine growing possible. And so the exact conditions of humidity and temperature and seasonal change that all this water provides is the basis for our wine-making economy, which is a $4.8 billion a year industry. And then it's also intensely beautiful. So tourism is the other kind of twin pillar of our economy. And so against all that, this place that we all love and that's a source of drinking water for 100,000 people that has the ability to turn water into wine, against all that is a Houston-based gas company called Crestwood, who purchased 5 miles of prime lakeshore property to access these abandoned salt mines underneath our lake. We still mine salt here, and your listeners may well have Seneca Lake salt running through their veins if they've ever been in a hospital and received a saline drip IV bag. Some of that salt comes from here. We're very proud of that. Salt is necessary for life. But now this salt mine, 100-year-old salt, U.S. Salt is the name of it, salt facility, is under occupation by a Houston-based gas company. It still mines salt, but the main purpose is to make the holes in the ground bigger because what it wants to do is store the products of fracking in the salt caverns, not inside barrels like you would if it was a root cellar, but the unlined salt caverns themselves will serve as the vessels for pressurized gases, and there are 3 of them, methane, which is natural gas, propane, which is in liquid form, is the heating oil, and then butane, which is cigarette lighter fluid. All those things come out of the ground when you frack. There are pipelines that connect those salt caverns to major pipelines, the Dominion and the Millennium Pipeline, to carry all over the Northeast. Crestwood seeks to become the gas storage hub for the entire Northeast, and some of that, of course, would be destined for export. And that is not what we want. We do not intend for our economic future to be based on the storage of fracked gas under our drinking water. We know that that's the most dangerous way to store gas. We know there have been catastrophic accidents in other places that would not only ruin our drinking water but ruin our tourism and wine economy. We think it's insane. But because the federal government is in charge of much of that project, because the pipelines are involved and natural gas is involved, that approval has already happened. We tried mightily through all legal means to redress grievance. We brought good science to bear. We testified. We gave comments. We organized the public to send thousands of comments in opposition. And all that was simply ignored and swept aside by our Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which is a rogue agency as far as I can see. It has no congressional oversight. There's no appeal process. So we are left now with a civil disobedience campaign. So we are speaking with our bodies at the gates. We began with a handful of us being arrested on the day the approval was given to begin construction. A civil disobedience movement was born at the gates of Crestwood. We call ourselves We Are Seneca Lake.
I know there have been many creative arrest scenarios, like teachers one day and musicians another.
The musicians dance and perform while they blockade. Even when there's a big truck menacing them, they just break into four-part harmony. We were all dancing while blockading. And then, amazingly, while all those musicians were in custody, we got the very good news that the governor had banned fracking, so I could break that news to them and read them the headlines of the New York Times when they all came out of the jail. And, of course, they were reunited with their instruments, so they immediately began playing again and thus commenced dancing and singing on the streets of Watkins Glen. So this is a very joyful movement. We have a very deep bench. 161 arrests have occurred already, but we have more than 1,000 people now who have signed the Pledge to Protect Seneca Lake, which is a pledge to commit civil disobedience. We have, you know, those are people who still have to go through our training, which is very intense. We're very disciplined. So far, we haven't had any infiltrators or agent provocateurs. Nobody suddenly decided to, you know, go their own way here and create safety problems for the rest of us. And we do that through very careful vetting and discipline process. We will fill the jails. We will not pay fines. We are sending this rogue company back to Texas. It's not welcome here, and we're not stopping.
That was Sandra Steingraber, biologist, writer, and activist with We Are Seneca Lake and New Yorkers Against Fracking. I'm Melinda Tuhus for Wings.
What do we want? Climate justice. When do we want it? Now. These women were part of the vast crowds marching outside the United Nations climate talks in Lima, Peru, in December 2014. These talks have taken place annually for 21 years. The next one, starting November 30th in Paris, is supposed to result in a binding and universal agreement on climate from all the nations of the world. Among the non-governmental organizations working to forward this aim is the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. Melinda Tuhus talked with its founder upon her return from Lima.
Next up is Osprey Oriel Lake, co-founder and executive director of WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, who attended the Lima conference as well as the grassroots gatherings outside the conference.
Climate negotiations have been going on for quite some time. This was COP20, 20 years into this process, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, leading up to the large negotiations in Paris, France in 2015, where governments have agreed to make a global agreement together on climate change. So, you know, the significance of the events in Lima was to prepare the ground for that. Things are going very slow. It's a very frustrating process, and ultimately, we're not expecting it to reach the level of ambition that we really need the agreements to be to put a stop to climate change and start reversing this trend. But it's the one format in which all countries meet and have this conversation. So we have what we call an inside and an outside strategy in which we're working on the inside to influence the process as much as possible, influence governments as much as possible. We advocate that whatever kinds of laws are put in place, that they're gender responsive. And we advocate against false solutions, which are being discussed there, such as geoengineering and nuclear power. But most of our work is actually not inside the UN process, but outside creating pressure for local grassroots on-the-ground solutions and policies that we can more immediately affect. And women on the front lines, women from low-income communities, indigenous communities, having their voices heard is a really important thing so that we can do the best we can with that UN process.
Your organization and others say that women are suffering and will suffer most from climate chaos. Can you say some of the ways that's true?
Indigenous women, women from low-income communities, developing countries, do bear a heavier burden from the impacts of climate change because they're more reliant upon natural resources for their survival They live in areas that have poor infrastructure, which makes them particularly vulnerable. And we know that women comprise about 20 million of the 26 million people estimated to have been displaced by climate change. And there's just a host of studies that demonstrate how women are the most negatively impacted when disasters occur, mostly due to the fact that they care for the children at home and the elderly. They often lack transportation, and they also are providing most of the food and water for the homes. As an example, 60 to 80% of household food production in developing countries is done by women. So when we're talking about food security in a changing climate, food sovereignty, we're really talking about women. But it's pretty clear that while women continue to suffer disproportionately from environmental destruction and climate change, it's also true that they stand on the front lines of global efforts to revision and heal our world and bring solutions. And I work with so many women on the front lines who say, you know, we're not victims. We don't want to be seen as victims because worldwide women are on the front lines to protect our earth, you know, marches, blockades, community organizing, hands-on solutions. As an example, there's been a lot of studies done by the United Nations that show if you want programs that increase water and improve water in different communities in the developing world, if you don't involve the women, the water programs simply don't work because women are the ones who watch the water cycles, they collect the water, and you really need women's leadership in those programs to make them successful. And then looking more to North America, about 80% of all consumer purchases are decided by women. So we're looking in our organization at different ways to leverage the power of the purse, if you will, changing our lifestyle, our consumption patterns and actions in the global north, which we think can be a very important part of an ecosystem of solutions. So while we're looking at how women are impacted, they also are right at the forefront of change and solutions.
Osprey Oriole Lake, can you give us some specifics about how the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network participated inside and outside the UN climate talks in Lima?
I think it's really important to say about being in Lima, it's the first time one of these negotiations ever happened in Amazon country. You know, the Amazon forest is one of the key areas we need to protect in terms of climate stabilization. It's not just affecting people in the Amazon region, but also provides a great deal of our weather patterns in North America. We had a series of events to bring a lot of attention to the Amazon. I think it was good that leaders could see the conditions there and be more engaged with the forest and the indigenous populations there. So we had a formal site event hosting a series of indigenous women as well as non-indigenous women presenting clean energy technologies and that sort of thing and talking about the many kinds of solutions that women are engaged in. And we also released a report called the Women's Climate Action Agenda, which originated from the event we put on a year ago with 100 women leaders from around the world, in which we began to see the idea for this 80-page document that's a detailed analysis, naming false solutions and putting forth real solutions. It goes through an entire host of recommendations addressing unsustainable consumption and production in the global north, how to take action with common but differentiated responsibilities. We talk about leaving 80% of the oil in the ground, divestment from fossil fuel companies, investing in clean energy. We talk about the protection of rights of nature and the end of the commodification and ownership and exploitation of all ecosystems, how we can democratize our food, agriculture, and seed systems, the protection of the rights of indigenous peoples, and how we transform our extractive economies, which is so important right now, and how we move to a socially just and environmentally sustainable economic pattern. And, of course, something very central to our organization, which is really the promotion of women's rights and women's leadership in all steps of climate change, adaptation, and mitigation. And inside the UN, we also work very closely with the Women and Gender Constituency, which is led by organizations like the Women Environment and Development Organization, WEDO, and Women in Europe for Common Future, WCF. And these are, you know, very long-standing, prominent women's organizations internationally who are really directing the leadership of women's groups inside the UN. And I think, you know, I just really want to commend the work that they do. And together, we all do work advocating to the delegates and to governments. insisting upon a fundamental framework of a rights-based agreement, climate justice, gender equality, women's rights, indigenous people's rights, historic responsibilities, and supporting the leadership of the women inside the climate negotiations. And then we also did several events on the outside, you know, parallel to the negotiations. And we held a really big event in downtown Lima called Women Leading Solutions on the Frontlines of Climate Change, a half-day event where we invited a lot of our indigenous allies from Ecuador and Peru and Brazil so that indigenous women would have a forum to really express what's going on with all the extraction on their lands, mineral and oil extraction, and particularly deforestation being a primary cause of carbon emissions in the atmosphere. We were very, very moved by a lot of the indigenous women and their strength and their power. And I have to say, you know, a lot of their courage, because defenders of the land are being persecuted very heavily in South America. There's been a lot of increase in deaths, as the organization Global Witness has been tracking for quite some time. A lot of cracking down on defenders of the land and environmentalists for standing up. We were very fortunate that Democracy Now! Came and they filmed our event and gave us some wonderful exposure through a piece that they did on Democracy Now! So people can view that.
For those who would like to view speakers from this Women's Earth and Climate Action Network event held during the UN Climate Conference in Lima, Wings recommends searching on the website democracynow.org. Here are a few excerpts from those talks.
Ai kaheme tua se, aheme tua se wareng ahau pe wanu pe, ahei hei hei. Uma saudação inicial na língua do meu povo que significa feliz por estarmos juntos.
So this is a traditional song from my people. And it's basically saying we're happy to be together.
Eu sou Sônia Guajajara, né, do estado do Maranhão, que é uma região que está na região amazônica do Brasil.
And my name is Sônia Guajajara, and my people are from the state of Maranhão, which is in the Amazon in Brazil.
E eu trago aqui a
and
voz,
I'm here to bring the voice of indigenous women, in particular of Brazil, those who couldn't be here with us, and all of them who would say the same thing so that we could unite our voices.
Porque, lamentavelmente, muitos de nossos povos,
because the reality is that in many of the organizations, there's not a space for women and indigenous women to participate. And so many times they feel suffocated for the words that they cannot say.
Casey Camp Hornick, she's from the Ponca Nation in Turtle Island, or the United States of America.
We're living in a very destructive area where I am. We have ConocoPhillips. We have fracking. We have earthquakes as a result of that fracking. We have fish kills. We have cancer rates that are astronomical at this time. We have literal killings. They may not be coming after us with their bayonets and their rifles, but they're coming at us with nuclear waste. They're coming at us with fracking. They're coming at us with pipelines that are carrying that filth from the tar sands where they're killing my relatives up there. And they're bringing it to you.
Nina Gualinga is a Quechua youth leader from the Sadiaco people.
I grew up in a beautiful place in the rainforest of Ecuador, in Sarayaku. I don't have words to describe my childhood, but it was beautiful. I cannot ask for anything else. When I was about 7 years old, maybe eight, this representative of an oil company called CGC came to Sarayaku. It was an Argentinian oil company. And I did not speak Spanish, but I saw that my elders, my mother, and all the people in Sarayaco were worried and there was tension. I did not know what was going on, and I asked my mother, what is going on? Because everyone had gathered in this place we call Plaza to talk about what was happening. And all the children were playing outside, but I sat down beside my mother and I asked her to translate for me. That was the first time I feared for that my land and the life that I knew was going to be destroyed.
Patrice Gualinga, an indigenous Quechua leader from Sarayaco people in Ecuador.
La destrucción de la naturaleza.
The destruction of nature is the destruction of our own energy and of our own existence here on Earth. And the destruction of our spaces is the destruction of the indigenous populations. And even though you might not believe this, this is your destruction as well.
You've just heard some of the voices at this remarkable event called Women Leading Solutions on the Front Lines of Climate Change, hosted by WECAN, Women's Earth and Climate Action Network.
Thank you, Democracy Now! Here again is WECAN founder Osprey Oriel-Lake speaking with Melinda Tuhus.
The Women's Earth and Climate Action Network is also on the steering committee of the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature. There was an International Rights of Nature Tribunal held in downtown Lima for 2 days where we heard 12 very powerful cases from around the world of violations against Mother Nature herself, against the ecosystems, against the Earth. And these were continuing cases, everything from the Great Barrier Reef to fracking to climate change to specific cases, as an example, in Ecuador around oil in the Yasuni area, which is a very diverse area of the Amazon forest. And hearing these cases from the perspective of the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, and are these different actions, violations against Mother Earth, and the premise there being that we really need to stop treating nature as property and start really seeing nature as a rights-bearing entity, and how we can really, as human beings, harmonize our lifestyle and our way of living with nature and the natural laws of the earth. People all over the world offering testimony. It was a very, very powerful and, I would say, heartbreaking experience hearing a lot of these cases, but it was also very empowering for people to participate in the tribunal. Also, there was the People's Climate Summit, and part of that was a very large march in the streets of Lima on International Human Rights Day, which was just incredibly powerful and joyous and strong and such a statement of solidarity. They said it was the largest climate march in Latin America in history.
I was going to ask you if you thought it was worth the trip, since so often these talks just end in disappointment, but I guess you thought it was.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of these international gatherings are really key for civil society, environmental organizations, human rights organizations, indigenous rights organizations, social justice movements, to really gather and meet on our own and strategize together, have our voices be heard, to be able to have direct action, to be engaged in the process, to engage with our leaders. So I think it's extremely valuable because, you know, if we're not there making a stand and if we're not making our presence known, then we're not influencing the process at all. And I don't think that that's productive or wise.
That was Osprey Oriel-Lake, co-founder and executive director of WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. I'm Melinda Tuhus for WINGS.
For more about WINGS, email wings@wings.org. Or check our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.